In a moment, we'll have our first keynote for the day, and I'll invite Professor Stephen Bevans to join us. I think many of you know Stephen. He's a priest of the Society of the Divine Word. He is a professor of mission and culture at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago. He's taught in many parts of the world, but importantly for us here in the Asia-Pacific region, he's taught in the Philippines, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. It's not Stephen's first visit to Australia, and I think as we listen to him, we'll hear that he has actually understood something of who we are. Stephen visited in 2005 and 2009, and I think many of you know his books, and some of those books will be on sale during the conference, so you'll have an opportunity, if you're quick, to get him to autograph your books. So without too much ado, I'll introduce to you Professor Stephen Bevans.
In 2009 is the last time I was here in Australia, and I gave a number of talks around the country in different venues, trying to develop a theology of mission that began with this conviction that the best way to speak about God is not to imagine God as a noun, but rather to imagine God as a verb. Of course, I want to say right away, this is not like some new kind of literalism that I'm trying to bring in. There's no way, really, we can ever talk about God. We can ever capture the reality of God. God is, as such, incomprehensible and ineffable. But I think trying to imagine God as a verb, as pure movement, as embrace, as flow, I think this captures this ineffability and this incomprehensibility in a particular kind of way. And the interesting thing, as I thought about this, you know, 5 or 6 years I began having this insight and began realizing how rich it is to understand, or at least to get into the mystery of God, you know, that we know that God offers God's self, but nevertheless, even when we are in relationship with God, we are held by God. God does not hold us. I mean, we are held by God. We do not hold God, as it were. But this really is not a new idea. This is an idea that I think goes at least back to someone like Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages. Aquinas, his idea that God is actus purus. God is pure activity. And again, as Elizabeth Johnson says, God is, commenting on Aquinas' idea, that God is the verb in which all beings participate, live and move and have their being. It's interesting, too, that Aquinas' friend and contemporary, sometimes a little bit of adversary, Bonaventure, teaching at the same university in Paris, talks the same way about God. Doesn't use the Aristotelian metaphysical language of pure action, pure being, but rather uses the idea that God is self-diffusive love. Some of you perhaps know the works of or have heard my colleague at CTU, Anthony Gittins, talk. And one time I was listening to Tony talk, and he said, you know, God is like love hitting the cosmic fan. You know, I think that's kind of, you know, a modern way of putting what Bonaventure says. Also very interesting, too, Bonaventure's great contemporary, Bonaventure and Aquinas' great contemporary, Mechtild of Magdeburg, famous medieval mystic, talks about God in her writings as that great outflow of love that never ceases. And Mechtild says, God as such is flow. God is a communion which is a flow. She talks about, in kind of traditional language, how the Father is the restless Godhead, and a flowing that no one can block. And she talks about the Son as constantly recurring richness that no one can contain except the boundlessness which always flowed and shall ever flow from God, and which comes again as the fullness of the Son. Contemporary theology, too, as I say, is taking this up. I've already mentioned Elizabeth Johnson and how she interprets Aquinas in this regard. Going back a few years, it's very interesting, Karl Barth says this about God. With regard to the being of God, the word event or act is final. Several years ago, I spent a semester in Oxford in the UK, and I met a wonderful Baptist theologian there by the name of Paul Fiddes. And Paul Fiddes has written an amazing book on the Trinity, and he calls the book Participating in God. He talks about the Trinity as the mystery of participation. And he says at one place in his writings, he says, you know, God is active in the world persuading, you know. And he says the divine persuasion is the attractiveness of movements of love, patterns of dance into which we are swept up. Every year I teach a course on ministry at Catholic Theological Union. And when it comes to beginning to talk about the theology of ministry, I talk first about how ministry always has Trinitarian foundations. And I play for my class a talk on the Trinity, a wonderful talk on the Trinity by the spiritual writer, very popular speaker, certainly around the United States, but I'm sure he's been here in Australia as well, Richard Rohr. And Richard Rohr, at a certain point, talks about the fact that God is that force of attraction that holds every atom and subatomic particle together. And he says, God, maybe going even beyond Aquinas, God is not just being, God is interbeing. And he plays, like many theologians do, on this classic Greek word perichoresis, which means a kind of a going around, but it's very similar to the Greek word perichoroia or perichoresis, which means dance. And Rohr says it's important that it's not, you know, God is the dance itself, not the dancer. God is the dance itself. And I myself have often imaged the idea of God as dance as a conga line. You know that kind of Latin American dance where someone starts out and they have this Latin beat and they begin to dance like this, you know, and then someone grabs them by the back and then they start moving and they just move all through the room. And I think of God is like that. God leads us in the dance. God becomes the dance itself and gathers people together to weave through, to flow through, to move through the world, gathering more and more of all creation, all humanity into that dance that gives wholeness, that dance that gives joy. Richard Rohr also uses the image of a rubber band. I don't know if that's the way you say that here in Australia, but a rubber band. And he says that when he was beginning to give this talk, he knelt down on the floor of his hotel, and he was praying, you know, saying, you know, God, keep me out of the way and let me really present your message. And he said, my eyes saw a rubber band. And he said, you know, that's exactly what the Trinity is like, what God is like. The rubber band goes out and it gathers creation, gathers people in, and then sends out again, and then gathers people in. And so God is that movement, that movement of a rubber band that moves out, gathers in into communion, the same communion that God is in God's self, and then sends out again. And American theologian Kathleen Cahalan says that what this points to, that what God is in essence, we know by what God does. And so if God is moving out, gathering in, God is in God's very self a gathering. God is in God's very self a communion. And so, again, another young American theologian by the name of Edward Hanenberg says that the crucial move in understanding the Trinity is that to see that the God who works for communion by the going out and the bringing back reveals the fact that God in God's deepest self is communion. Which brings us to our second point, that God is mission. God is that movement, that pure activity, that overflowing love, that flow that Mechtild talks about, that dance, that embrace of creation, that is going out and bringing in, calling creation to fullness, calling creation to wholeness, and where necessary, calling creation to healing. God is, to use Paul Fitz's language, the mystery of participation that calls women and men on this speck of dust in the universe, this small planet, in this minor galaxy, in this mind-bogglingly immense universe, into relationship and into partnership in calling creation, calling humanity into relationship. Another way of saying this is that God, in God's very self, is mission. That what God is mission. And the first act of mission is the act of creation. Mission begins with creation. It ends, as we heard yesterday in the second reading, with new creation. But creation is really, I think, the key to it all. So the first act of mission of God is creation. And so from the first nanosecond, God is present in this creation, moving in this creation, embracing this creation by the power of the Holy Spirit. Dennis Edwards, who I'm sure you all know, talks about how that Spirit is present, guiding, persuading, inspiring the evolution of the gases, the formation of the billions of planets, calling forth life. This is God's mission, moving out, persuading, cajoling, giving freedom, and yet moving among creation to bring all of this about. And then committing God to healing and reconciliation as free-willed human beings emerge and begin to mess things up. And then still, as Vatican II's document on mission says, present in a secret way, as a secret presence, in all the gropings and searching and everything from the first moment when human beings begin to recognize that there's something greater, something broader than themselves. And so that Spirit is that secret presence in all the religions of the world that begin to emerge as humanity emerges. In our Judeo-Christian tradition, this imminent, always present, life-giving, persuading, inspiring, healing, and reconciling presence of God is imaged in the Old Testament in these kind of elusive kind of images. Wind, breath, the oozing of oil, the flowing of water, or the soaring of a bird. So the Spirit is revealed in the Old Testament among the Hebrew people in many different practices. And so, first of all, we see in Genesis the Spirit as depicted as a creative wind, blowing like a primeval chaos, and being like a mother bird hovering over the nest, bringing forth newness, bringing forth life. And we read how in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, God breathes life into the earth creature, Ha Adam, not yet a male, an amorphous earth creature. You know, and eventually from him, woman emerges, and we have, equality and so forth. But the breath of life is the breath of life of the Spirit breathing into this creature. We read in the book of Samuel how the Spirit stirs Saul to prophecy. He's anointed king by Samuel, and then he joins a band of prophets, and the Spirit comes down upon him, and he begins to prophesy. So the Spirit is the reality of God that prophesies. We see the Spirit as that refreshing, life-giving wind that blows over that valley of the dry bones. In Ezekiel chapter 37, when we see those bones begin to rattle and begin to find each other, and the Spirit begins to put flesh on these bones, and so new life comes into being through the blowing Spirit in this valley of the dry bones. Or the Spirit is depicted as water, life-giving water, that flows from the right side of the temple. And everywhere that water touches, new life comes up. It flows into the Dead Sea and makes the waters fresh. The trees on every side of the river give fruit every month, and the leaves are used for healing. This is how the Hebrews, the Jewish people, depicted God passing by and drawing near, as Elizabeth Johnson would put it. We see also in the prophet Isaiah how the Spirit is like the ointment that anoints the prophet for mission, to give comfort to the afflicted, to heal the brokenhearted, freedom for those in captivity. And in the book of Proverbs, the Spirit is depicted as Sophia, a woman prophet who walks the streets, preaching in the streets, calling people to repentance, calling people to new life. So in sum, again, as Elizabeth Johnson says, when we speak of the Spirit, what we're actually signifying is God in mission. God drawing near and passing by, in vivifying, sustaining, renewing, and liberating power in the midst of historical struggle. And then in the fullness of time, that palpable yet elusive presence of God in the Spirit takes on human flesh, takes on a human face. And if the Spirit was the major way in the Bible, in the Old Testament, that described God's practice, you know, of vivifying and bringing back to life and healing and creating prophets. If the Spirit was the major way that the Bible described those practices of God, now the Spirit that has pervaded the universe from the first instant of creation is, again, as Elizabeth Johnson says, manifest in time in the loving, gifting, and befriending first century Jewish carpenter turned prophet. This is seen, this relationship between Jesus and the Spirit is seen particularly at the beginning of the Gospel of Luke. I was amazed that earlier this calendar year, we were reading the beginning of the Gospel of Luke in the Sunday readings, and I was really struck by how the Spirit is so enmeshed with Jesus' life. And it's like the Spirit hands on what the Spirit has been doing heretofore to this man Jesus. And we see it, it's really interesting, that the Spirit, as Jesus is baptized in the Jordan, descends on Jesus as a dove. And then the text switches to the genealogy. And this genealogy takes Jesus back to Ha-Adam, to Adam, into whom the Spirit first breathed life. So Jesus' genealogy goes back to that first moment of life. And then Jesus is described as full of the Holy Spirit. The Spirit leads Jesus into the desert, and he's tempted by the evil spirit. And so you have the battle of the spirits. And then after defeating the devil, Jesus is again described in the text as filled with the Holy Spirit as he is seen to be going around to various towns and preaching in their synagogues. And then, in the famous text of chapter 4, 16 to 21, Jesus returns to his hometown and to his synagogue. And Luke, as we all know, has him, you know, sit down, take up, or rather stand up, take up the scroll. And in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus reads, these are the first public words that Jesus speaks. Either he's spoken, of course, already to Mary and Joseph and the temple. He obviously spoke in the synagogue, but we don't know what he says. But in Luke 4, he unrolls that scroll, and the first thing he says is, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." And that text, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, God has anointed me to bring good tidings to the poor, to bring healing to the lame, to bring sight to the blind," and so forth. That's the agenda of Jesus' mission. It's the agenda of our mission. That's the agenda of Jesus' mission. And we can see that then in his practice, the way he practices his ministry, his mission. First of all, you know, Jesus proclaims God's message in words. This message of acceptance and forgiveness and reconciliation and inclusion and commitment to the poor. He does this, you know, taking his agenda from that text, giving the good news to the poor. He does this in these stunning parables. Parables like in Luke 15 about God's incredible, amazing, generous mercy. You know, scholars say that if by chance we would lose all the Gospels, we would lose the whole whole New Testament, if we still had Luke 15, we would possess the essence of the gospel. The shepherd going in search of the lost sheep. The woman tearing her house up to find the lost coin. And the father braving the insults of his younger son. And when the son comes back, braving the insults of his older son to forgive his son who has squandered so much of his inheritance, so much of his fortune. Also parables about God's generosity. Matthew 20 is that parable of the workers in the vineyard. How the master goes out, sends one group into the vineyard at the beginning of the day, then goes back at another hour, sends more, goes back at another hour, sends more, goes back at another hour, sends more, but then when he comes to pay, he pays all of them equally. The ones who have worked all day, of course, grumble, but he says, can I not simply be generous? Can I not be generous? I'm generous in giving even those who don't deserve it, in giving them the same for those who have worked all day. Or parables about God's radical inclusion. The parable of the wedding banquet. Go out to the highways and byways. Bring everybody in, because everybody, no matter who they are invited to this banquet, to the reign of God. And then one of my favorite parables is the parable that points, I think, to God's vulnerability and commitment to justice. This is the parable of the unjust judge and the persistent widow. And I take the exegesis of one of my colleagues at CTU, Barbara Reed, who says, you know, she thinks that, well, you know, the parable starts out in Luke's version. Jesus told this parable in order that we should pray without ceasing and never get disheartened. And the parable, of course, is about that woman with the unjust judge, and she keeps bothering him and bothering him and bothering him until, to get rid of her, he gives her what he wants. And somehow or another, Luke saw that as a parable of prayer. Barbara says, if the judge is an image of God, what a lousy image that is of God. You know, so I always think, you know, we have to cajole God, we have to beg God, you know, for what we want. And then, you know, I always think, like, you know, we die and go to heaven, and we ask God, well, why didn't you heal my brother who was dying of cancer? And God would say, well, you know, you just weren't persistent enough. If you had done one more rosary, I would have done it. You know, I mean, it's what an image of God. Well, what Barbara says is, let's turn that thing on its head. Let's imagine that the woman is God, and that the unjust judge are the injustices of the world, and that God, in all vulnerability, is constantly, constantly working against injustice. And maybe we'll, you know, sometimes have a victory and sometimes won't. But God never gives up. God is like that persistent widow. And she says, you know, it makes sense because God is depicted as a woman in the parable of the lost coin. God is depicted as a woman when it talks about how a woman puts yeast in the dough, and that's like the reign of God. So Luke has this motif, and it makes sense and certainly points to the deep vulnerability of God, as we see as Jesus eventually moves through his life to the cross. Jesus also practices healings and exorcisms in his ministry. This is in his agenda and on Luke 4, recovery of sight to the blind, release to captives. These are parables in action, these healings. They point to what God is doing in our world, and they point to the fact that God's practices are not just for our spiritual benefit. God gets down and dirty. God gets God's hands dirty. And that the salvation that God offers through the ministry of Jesus is one that is fully, fully human. And Jesus himself, as theologian Edward Skillebeck says, Jesus himself was a parable. Look at his own practices of personal freedom over against the law and what that says about what salvation is about. Or his fun-loving lifestyle. He was accused of being a wine-bibber, a drunkard. His inclusive behavior, hanging out with the marginalized of his time. And I think all this points to a God who gives life and joy, who cares for all, who offers inclusion and freedom. This was the community Jesus was developing, forming, that he called the reign of God, and points to that again on his agenda in Luke 4. He was proclaiming and acting out a year of favor to the Lord. But, of course, that was the problem. As American Latino theologian Virgilio Elizondo says, Jesus' practice of not being scandalized by anyone was what really scandalized the religious leaders of his day. And probably, he says, the biggest reason why those leaders plotted to put him to death. Jesus died because of what he practiced. Noel Connolly writes in a paper that he gave just this past week in Rome at a conference, that Jesus' death is not the denial of divinity, but a true revelation of what divinity is all about. In 2009, when I was here and I was giving some classes at the Broken Bay Institute, and it was the first time that I had heard of the Australian cartoonist Michael Lunick. And I remember when I left, Gerard Goldman, my great friend, gave me about 4 volumes of Michael Lunig's cartoons. And I really enjoyed reading those and praying with them and so forth. But when I went back to Melbourne, where I was teaching at YTU, Good Friday, there was a cartoon that appeared in the paper. What happened to that? It disappeared. Oh, I know. It's here. It's here. It's 2 soldiers, looking at the crucifixion and talking with one another, and they say, "Look at that. Brilliant. You kill the leader and you nip the whole movement in the bud." We know it didn't happen like that, though. You know, we can't kill God. Or as John Thornhill says, God will have his way. Love will have his way, or its way. You can't stop that movement. You can't stop that flow. You can't stop God's embrace or God's dance through the world. You can't stop God's practices. So within days, you know the story, the disciples who had fled in terror from Jesus, who had left Jerusalem disillusioned, who had locked themselves away in fear, they began to experience Jesus as raised from the dead. But not only that, at Pentecost, they began to realize that the Spirit and that the mission given to Jesus was now given to them. Just as the Spirit's practices, as we saw, of life-giving and freeing, of prophecy and forgiving, were embodied in Jesus, so now those practices were being embodied in them. This happened gradually, of course, and it's really interesting to read the Acts of the Apostles. It just didn't happen at Pentecost. But it was a very agonizing moment. You read from chapter 2 to about chapter 11 in the Acts of the Apostles, and you see that gradual realization of who they have become after Jesus' resurrection and after the descent of the Spirit at Pentecost. Their original idea was that mission was only for the Jews. And gradually, through Stephen, and then the persecution that happened after Stephen's murder, some went to the Samaritans, half-Jews. They accepted the Word of God. Then there's the story of the eunuch, what I call a wannabe Jew. He wanted to be a Jew, but because of his physical condition, he couldn't officially convert to Judaism. But Philip came, gave him the proclamation of the gospel. They saw the water by the wayside. The eunuch says, "Is there anything that would prevent me from being baptized?" And Philip says, "No," and baptizes him. And then there's the story in chapter 10, chapter 10 of Cornelius, a Gentile, a member of the occupying army, who, when Peter preaches to him, received the same Spirit. And remember, when Peter goes back to Jerusalem, the other 11 say, "Peter, what did you do? You can't let a non-Jew into our community. He's a Gentile." And Peter said, "Well, I don't know what happened, but the same Spirit that came upon us came upon Cornelius and his whole family. And so I simply had to baptize him." And then there's the story in chapter 11 of Antioch, where the disciples who had been persecuted after Stephen's murder went to Antioch, preached to Jews, but then also preached en masse to non-Jews. Antioch's the third largest city in the Roman Empire, teeming with all sorts of religions and Greek culture is very strong. The people there hear the message, and they accept the message with joy. And Jerusalem has a real problem with this. They send someone to check it out, Barnabas, and Barnabas says, "It's genuine." And, you know, it seems to me that when they went to Antioch, and when they really crossed those boundaries of Judaism, it was then that the church was born. So realizing that they had been invested with God's mission and practice, it was in that that they understood themselves as church. So the church comes to be as people engaged in mission, as they recognize the fact that just like the Spirit had been lavished on the world from the first moment of creation, just as the Spirit had anointed Jesus for his mission, so now they were anointed for mission in the world as well, to go to the ends of the earth, to preach the gospel to all peoples for all time. And that's why I think we can say that the church is missionary by its very nature. The church doesn't have, you know, we don't gather together as church and then go on mission. It's rather mission that calls us to be who we are, to be the church. And so we say, you know, in that phrase, that it's the mission that has a church, not the church that has a mission. So the church becomes the church as it engages in the practices of the Trinity, as it engages in Trinitarian practice. So our fourth point is that mission is partnering with God. The theology that I've been developing in my presentation so far is what we call the theology of the Missio Dei, or the theology of the mission of God. Has a long history in Christian theology, has roots in the Christian scriptures, has roots in the earliest theologians of the church and through the Middle Ages. It appeared in the French school in the 17th century. In the 20th century, it had a renewal under the theology of Karl Barth, and then this famous conference at Willingen in Germany in 1952. And Vatican II took that up in its document on mission, which talked about how the church is missionary by its very nature because it participates in that overflowing fountain, which is the Father who sends the Spirit and the Son into the world. The basic idea here is that the mission is not ours. The mission ultimately is God's. God's mission calls forth the church. God's mission, of course, is wider than the church's mission. God is primary. In the order of things, we are secondary. And our task is simply to point out where God is already at work. And this is kind of the theology of the Missio Dei. I think this is true, and this is the theology that I've certainly developed and I've written about and I've presented to you here, and it's certainly true. However, I'd like to push it a bit further in kind of my concluding remarks in this presentation. I would like to propose that we're more important than just being subordinate to God in mission. I don't think we're exactly subordinate, you know, second in the work of mission. I think the amazing thing is that God has called us to be partners in that mission. Just as the Spirit was lavished on Jesus, so that same Spirit is lavished on us. The Orthodox call this theosis, divinization. That in baptism, we are made like gods. What does that mean? I don't think it means that, you know, our DNA is changed or anything like that. I think it means that we are given the same mission that God has. So we're not second fiddle to God as we do mission. We are God's partners in mission. And I think that God's nature is to be a partner. I think the Trinity shows us the partnership of God. And I think God lives out that, if you will, you know, by making us, you and me, partners. Partnership, I think, is this basic practice of the Trinity. I think it's the whole point of the incarnation. Jesus is one of us. His mission is our mission. The Trinity is this mission, as Paul Fittis says, this mystery of participation. So in my view, the amazing grace is, if I can dare to say it, God needs us. We are the way that God's work gets done. God treats us as equals. God treats us as partners. Augustine said, without God we cannot. Without us, God will not. Even when the Spirit works outside the church, she needs people's cooperation. As John Oman says, the man I wrote my doctoral dissertation on, God does not force his mystery upon us. God calls for our partnership, our cooperation. But when God calls us to be partners, to be real sharers in the divine nature. And our task is to have the openness, the humility, the availability like Mary did. I think it's why the angel can say, you're full of grace. We need to work to be that open, to be that responsive so that we can live up to our task of being partners of God as we work with God in mission. And so like Mary, we are called to cooperate fully in God's work. As I say, I think this is the amazing grace of mission. It's participating in the work of the Trinity. It's Trinitarian practice. It's partnering with the missionary God. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'll start by promising that I won't bore you with the governance thesis dissertation this morning. I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather today, the Gadigal people, a proud part of the Eora Nation. I thank Catholic Mission for the opportunity to provide this brief response this morning. The task that I was asked was to take Stephen's incredibly rich and indeed complex and apply it in practice through the lens of Catholic healthcare, whilst bringing along all in the audience not immediately involved in Catholic health in Australia. No small task. And indeed, the challenge made even greater by following such a terrific opening for our gathering from such a significant contributor to the matters we'll be discussing these few days. I'm going to apply the Trinitarian practice, if you like, that Stephen has advanced this morning by suggesting to you that there are three key themes that we might want to consider and debate these next 3 days. The first is this notion of the Trinity as a partnership and the opportunity for ourselves to be transformed as partners equal with God in fulfilment of this mission. The second is this Aquinian notion of God as a verb, God as a doing word, and what it means to apply these parables in action in our modern day with all the complexity in which our various ministries need to exist. And the final is this notion of Jesus being most scandalized by refusing himself to follow the rules of the time that in fact had him mixing it and, as Stephen said, getting his hands dirty with those considered themselves to be scandals at that time. So let's walk through those three different themes. The first is this notion of partnership. Applying the lens of Catholic health in this country and around the world, Catholic health draws its origins from that parable of the Good Samaritan, familiar to so many of us. This notion of healing the person injured on the side of the road, and particularly it being the Samaritan that went to that aid of the person injured, whilst others, including the priests, walked by and left them unattended. In the contemporary world, we are all, and the Church for many decades, indeed century, has been involved in that joint partnership of healing. Those of you that know the interests of Catholic Health Australia at the moment will probably have heard me talk previously about this notion of the social determinants of health. There are these building blocks of good health, and they are an unborn child's experiences in the womb. They are early childhood development. They're whether or not you get to finish school. They're whether or not you have a roof over your head. All of these factors have in fact been found to be just as important, and in some cases more important, than biomedical factors in determining a person's health outcome. In Australia, a person in the lowest 20% of income will die 3 years earlier than someone in the highest percent of income earners. An Indigenous person in different parts of the country will variably die 11 to 17 years earlier than a non-Indigenous person. This is not just a challenge for those of us involved in health. In fact, many of the solutions to these disparities in life expectancy between the haves and the have-nots in our Australian community, the solutions actually lie outside of the formal healthcare system. Of course, the church in this country and around the world has been running schools, has been providing supports to the poor, providing housing for centuries. It's the very work, the very mission of the church that we are involved in. But this notion that Stephen puts to us today of being transformed into partners is a challenge that exists very real in our time. To adopt the secular, a Senate inquiry just a month ago resolved that Australia needs to adopt a social determinants of health agenda articulated by the World Health Organisation. It would involve those involved in school education, those involved in welfare, playing a much more coordinated role with each other, together with the healthcare system, to advance human flourishing, to improve the lives of the most disadvantaged in our community. Now, I was able to present to that work of the Senate by saying, well, the church, it already has terrific street cred in this area. We have Catholic schools. We have social welfare services of the church as part of that mission that we're called for. But the challenge that Stephen's put to us today is this notion of partnership. As the Trinity acts as that partnership between the three, as we, as equals with God, in pursuit of that mission, how well can we in our practical world apply that notion of partnership, where schools might work with welfare, might work with health services? And I offer that challenge, recognising how difficult it is, even within the Catholic health sector, to see the opportunity for partnerships to be formed. The second theme that Stephen put to us is this notion as God as verb. Again, he put it as not a particularly new sentiment, but one that we need to revisit. This notion of the parable in action, actus purus, this notion of God as pure activity. It challenges all of us to ask again in this complex, complicated world in which we fulfil our various church ministries, how do we appropriately prioritise our time and energy to ensure actus purus? How do we ensure that the parables in action are the most effective? How do we know we are in fact working as equal partners with God in pursuit of that shared mission? In the very simple decisions that we have to make within the direction of our resources, the allocation of our time, the decisions that boards of governance need to make, that notion of actus purus, to have every meeting open, every board director's, every committee meeting about how we're to make a decision, to be reminded of how are we ourselves as equal partners with God pursuing that actus purus. It challenges and confronts, particularly for so many of our ministries interacting in this secular world. This third notion that I put to you that Stephen has challenged us with is that of Jesus himself causing most scandal by himself, in Stephen's words, getting dirty with the most disadvantaged, the poor, the sinners of his time. Think about where our church is in our community in Australia and internationally today. Over these next few days, it's appropriate to think of the change that the Australian community is likely to experience in its regard for the church and indeed for Christianity as the Royal Commission into Child Sex Abuse works through its processes over these next few years. I learned from one in the audience, the Dean at Loretto Normanhurst this morning, who said to me that before the Royal Commission into Sex Abuse in Ireland got underway, about 50% of that population attended church. That has now fallen to some 35% in response to the revelations that arose from the inquiry in Ireland into child sexual abuse. It would be very easy for us to become despondent, to become depressed, to become forlorn by what this extraordinary challenge to the place of church within our community could mean for us in years ahead. I put it to you that we in fact should not be scandalised ourselves by this scandal that has occurred within our church. The windows need to be opened, the light needs to shine, and reparation is going to be required. But during that time, as partners equal with God in fulfilment of the mission that gives rise to this church of ours, surely this is the time where we must commit anew to walking with the poor, to ensuring that we can become partners in God, partners with each other in addressing those challenges articulated through the social determinants of health agenda. These are the thoughts that someone working in Catholic Health brings to you, having listened to that terrific opening that Stephen has given us this morning. But before I conclude, I couldn't possibly leave the stage without thanking Stephen for the terrific imagery of the cosmic fan, of God's mission being thrown against the cosmic fan, of God leading this conga line of dancers, of God in fact being the very dance, or the Trinity in fact being the dance. And of course, we don't often see enough visiting priests dance in front of us on our stage. If there was more dancing, perhaps our world would be a better place. And this final notion that Stephen put to us, perhaps glibly but very importantly, if we were to lose all of the Gospels, all of them, we would only need to hang on to Luke. Well, I sat in the front row and thought, oh, how extraordinary. There's not a chance of losing all of the Gospels. And as I was doing so, my electronic device beeped. I made the mistake of pressing a button and I instantly deleted something terribly important. In this world, where indeed our very bishops are now saying Mass from their iPad, the notion of the loss of the Gospel is both literal but also very real in our world, with so many unable, unwilling, or not in a position to hear these terrific words. It's the duty of all of us to ensure we don't lose the Gospel, that we all become those parables in action to ensure its longevity beyond all of us. Stephen, thank you for your extraordinary contribution, and thank you for making the trip to Australia.
Thank you, Martin, for helping us to begin to break open these ideas, for putting these ideas into dialogue with your experience in the healthcare sector, and particularly for reminding us that being drawn into partnership with God draws us into partnership with one another. Now, time for a deep breath and to think about what questions or comments we have for our keynote speaker and the respondent. Thank you.
My question is regarding the church's interplay with politics, politicians. There's a perceived notion that the church is separate to politics, and yet politicians make a lot of decisions that affect social policy. Do you think the church perhaps needs to go that extra step and be more involved with politics or politicians? Should there be a table where these two areas meet?
Okay, I'll throw to our panellist. Who would like to speak first?
Thank you very much, Stephen. I'm going to talk a little bit more to that issue tomorrow in my hands-on type of presentation tomorrow. But I do feel like sometimes there is this, this lack of listening to some of the issues that the wider world presents and which politicians somehow present as well. I'm thinking particularly in my context of the United States and some of the issues of healthcare, some of the issues of sexual issues and things like that, which have gotten into our political conversations and so forth. I think the church should not be too quick to say we have the answers, but that we need to have a dialogue. We need to listen to the kernel of truth that may be there. We don't want to compromise our principles, and yet Not everybody thinks the way we think. And in a democracy like Australia or the United States, I think there has to be a much broader conversation about these things. And I think, and I'll say this tomorrow a bit as well, but I think that's part of our mission. Otherwise, we just become people who are always talking and never listening. You know, always have all the answers and always, putting our answers on people. And I think the Spirit is active in a wider way than we are, and so we need to have that kind of conversation. So I think it's just too simple to say separation of church and state, and like we say in the United States, but it's also too simple to say that we have all the answers and we are going to insist on this and, push the politicians away. I mean, I see how, sometimes church leadership has kind of shunned our president and some of his initiatives and things like that, and not seeing all the good stuff and just focusing on a few small things. And I think that just alienates church from the wider public, and I think a better conversation needs to happen. So that's
thank you, Stephen. I look forward to hearing a bit more about that tomorrow. It'll be really good to hear something from Martin, because of course this is an ordinary part of your work, dialogue with politicians about policy.
Well, I need to declare interest that I earn my living doing that very thing, so of course I'm going to say yes, of course the church should be involved in politics. But the reality is, politics is a tough, demanding debate that works both ways. Yeah. If you are going to inject yourself into the town square and articulate a case, you have to anticipate that on any given day, at least 49%, if not 51%, of your audience is immediately going to disagree with you. That is the nature of politics in this country and so often around the world. The church in Australia structures itself so that our ministries, education, health, welfare in particular, are well integrated into the nature of government as opposed to politics. And I think the importance of that distinction, how we engage in the decisions of government as opposed to whether or not we become partisan, is exceptionally important. And I'll give a live illustration occurring literally today. Catholic Health Australia found itself last week on the front page of The Australian for 3 days in a row, arguing a pretty difficult case. The Australian government is requiring that aged care providers increase salaries for low care workers. We agree. Low care workers deserve the pay increases they're proposed. But the Australian government hasn't brought to the table sufficient finance to meet those pay increases. So we've had to argue a case that says the objective of increasing pay for low-paid workers is something the church stand behind, but government must ensure that it brings the resources with it. Because we've made that case, we've received the criticism back, and we went into that discussion quite knowingly that if you enter the town square, you have to be ready for the debate. You need to strap your boots on, because just because you are church in this country in these times is no longer enough for your argument to be proven correct.
Thank you. And next question was from here.
My question, I'm still a little bit unsure how to phrase it, but I wonder how, Father Stephen, you see the Eucharist as source and summit in all of what you have said, because in a way the statement was made to me the other day, perhaps a lot unfairly, but oh, you just want to be a Christian, you don't want to be a Catholic. And I sort of wonder, because I fully, what you've presented speaks to my heart very much, how do we make this particularly Catholic as opposed to, or in the midst of also our Christianity? So sorry, that may not be as clear as I'd like it to be, but it's mm-hmm. it's this sense of the place of Eucharist within what you're saying.
Sure.
Thanks, Darren.
Thanks very much. I think that's a great question and an important question. My task, as I saw it, was to kind of present a broader vision of mission. I have in some places talked more specifically Catholic, but let's focus on that idea of the Eucharist, which I think is really important. I got an insight. I was doing some study of Vatican II and its whole relationship to mission. And one of the, as I looked at Vatican II more and more, it's not just, you know, the document on mission where Vatican II talks about mission. It's in almost every document. It's something that runs through it. And one of the things I noticed was that this idea in the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, I don't remember what paragraph, 7 perhaps, something like that, I'm not sure, but it talks about the liturgy as the source and summit of Christian life. No, and I think that is a missionary statement. Because it's the source, it's the summit, you know, to which we go to, but it's also the source of the way we live our lives. I'm going to be talking a little bit about this tomorrow because I have a section where I'm going to talk about liturgy as mission. And so that you know will come out there. But I think the whole thing, particularly Eucharist, for instance. One of my professors was fond of saying that Eucharist is not just about bread and wine becoming the body and blood of Christ. It's about you and me becoming the body and blood of Christ in the world. You know, and so really, you know, in Eucharist, we are remembered, as it were, into the body of Christ, and and so that we can be the body of Christ in the world. The sacrifice is the sacrifice that we live out in our own lives of service and love and goodness and sharing and so forth that comes from the Eucharist. You know, so I mean, I think that's where. It's a particularly Catholic understanding of what mission is about. One of my colleagues at CTU is and I may repeat some of this stuff tomorrow, but one of my colleagues at CTU in Chicago says that we do liturgy in church so that we can worship God by our lives in the world. You know, and so again, it makes liturgy really a missionary activity. You know, and so I think that's how I would approach that. You know, it's profoundly. I mean, we can talk about how the mission calls forth the church. Henri de Lubac talks about how the Eucharist makes the church, not the church makes the Eucharist. You know, so it is this wider thing that we participate in, you know, that calls us into being and into mission.
Thank you. That was an excellent question, and you've helped us with some language to begin to make those linkages clearer when some Catholics might focus more on liturgy and others more on mission. Mm-hmm. To make those links clear and not be able to articulate them is very helpful. Just looking around now to see if there's another question. Yes? Patrick, yes. There's a microphone coming down from the back for you.
Thank you very much, Father Stephen, for a very enlightening and inspiring presentation on mission.
Thank you.
I have one small quibble, if I may.
Sure.
You presented delightfully about the presence and action of the Spirit from creation through the prophets as the flow and the energy and the dance, and then the Spirit coming on the Word. But I felt that it gives the impression that the Word is absent. And that's my quibble. And I think it can be very easily included by the Word of creation is let it be.
Yes,
so
right.
The Word is present from the very moment of creation. And the Word is where the Spirit flows, then the Word is the direction of the flow. And the Word is spoken by the prophets, thus says the Lord, and so on, and comes to a particular expression, of course, in the incarnate Word. So wherever there is the Spirit, there is the Word. Wherever there is the Word, there is the Spirit. The action of them, the mission of them, always together, all time, from the beginning through to the end.
Yes, thank you. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think you see that most clearly at, you know, in that, in those opening chapters of Luke, you know, that I was pointing out. And I guess for simplicity's sake, I focused on the movement of the Spirit and the handing over of the Spirit to Jesus and so forth. It's obviously, as you point out, more complex than that. But the other thing is that and I don't have chapter and verse of this, but there's a line that goes through a lot of church documents on mission that talks about how the Spirit is the one who sows the seeds of the Word. You know, so that connection. So, you know, Justin Martyr's idea of the logos spermaticos, the seeds of the Word, or the seed of the Word, that the Vatican II's document on mission took up, is kind of expressed in that way that the Spirit is always connected with the Word, you know. And of course the Word of God, as you say, through the prophets, is so strong. And the Logos tradition, which of course the Logos tradition in Philo, taken up by John in the prologue, is also the wisdom tradition, you know, which is Sophia, you know, and so the two really do work together. And thank you for pointing that out. I think that's really important. I just wanted to, you know, kind of have a narrative presentation to highlight the working of the Spirit. But it is more complex, and I appreciate that.
Thank you. We'll have one more question in the middle. Anne, please. Can we pass the microphone along?
Thank you very much. I have a bit of a saying now in the context of today's time that the earth is the prophet now. Are we listening? And do we know how to listen? And if not, how can we learn?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think the consciousness that has arise, what Pope John Paul II called the ecological conversion, you know, that people have to undergo in our world, is changing everything. I mean, it's changing the way we think theologically. It's changing our spirituality. That we see ourselves as not over creation or over against creation, but a part of creation and the part of earth. I think this is where, you know, our Aboriginal brothers and sisters are miles ahead of us, you know, in this kind of understanding from, you know, their beginning. But yes, I think that's really, really important. And I think some of these things are anticipating what I'm going to say tomorrow, but I think that one of the cutting edge areas in terms of mission has to be in the area of what Pope Francis has called the protection of creation. You know, and so this is, you know, absolutely essential, as I understand it. And thank you for you know, highlighting that. I hope it was present in what I was saying, you know, but for highlighting that, it's very important.
I'm sorry to draw this opportunity for dialogue to a close just when we're beginning to warm up, I think, but we will have a chance to talk with one another over morning tea, and I'm sure the speakers will also be available for conversation. Do try to let them get a cup of tea first, though. But could we just thank Stephen and Martin?
Thank you.